You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Let me just adjust this really quickly. You've done this before, right?
Yeah, I've done it before.
Nice. Okay. You ready?
Yep, ready.
Hello, I'm Brian Wood. This is About Asia. And today we have someone with us for the second time, supervising producer Jonathan Vitt. John, the last time you were on this podcast, you were here to talk about the Japanese mafia, the Yakuza. But today, you've got something different for us.
That's right. Today I'm here to talk about fashion.
Fashion?
Specifically, Harajuku fashion. So what comes to mind when you hear the word Harajuku?
As an early 2000s kid, I think of Harajuku Girls by Gwen Stefani. Harajuku Girls, you got the wickedest style. And of course, I think bright colors, big costume-like silhouettes.
Yeah, the neighborhood, which is in the Japanese capital, Tokyo, has for a long time now been associated with fashion. But it's not just any kind of fashion. Harajuku is known as the birthplace of these really wild, over-the-top, distinct looks that sort of captured the world's attention back in the early 2000s. I spoke with Yana Katzenberg, a PhD researcher and lecturer in the Japanese Studies Department at the University of Cologne, who spent a lot of time researching the history and culture of Harajuku fashion. I asked Yana what drew her to the topic as an academic.
The first time I encountered Japanese fashion, Harajuku fashion, was on the pages of the German Vogue, who were introducing Shoji Aoki's first fruits book that got like a more worldwide release. And yeah, I really begged my mom to buy this book for me because it was just like fashion like I'd never seen it before. They had like crazy, like gravity-defying styles.
I actually have the book Yana was talking about here in the studio.
Oh, nice. Okay, cool. I mean, I like a lot of these looks. Some of these aren't even really, they wouldn't be that shocking if I saw them today.
Yeah, I think it's important to like put yourself in the context of like the early 90s. Maybe at the time, this seemed very surprising. But today, you're right, it looks pretty normal.
Yeah, I would even wear one of these to the office if our boss was okay with it, of course. Okay, so we know what got Yana interested in this, but what about you? You're an American, you've lived in Asia for quite some time, but still, what got you into the subject?
Well, I'm sort of broadly interested in pop culture and how it is recontextualized over time. There's often a deeper historical and social context behind pop culture phenomenon that gets lost when it breaks out to a wider audience. And digging into the history of subcultures or musical styles can actually tell you a lot about the time and the place that it originated in. As I learned in my reporting for this story, that was especially true for Harajuku fashion subcultures. They took off in the West without any of the surrounding context that was available for Japanese audiences, and it felt like at the time another iteration of the weird Japan trope that Western news media loves to cover. But even though it entered the West as this entirely foreign thing, it somehow held on in popular consciousness, despite, for a while at least, being sort of dead in Harajuku.
Dead? What happened?
That's sort of a tough question, because while it was famously declared dead in 2017, that's when the iconic fashion magazine Fruits published its final issue, there are still shops today that are dedicated to Harajuku fashion subcultures, and there are still people wearing these clothes.
Okay, so it isn't dead?
Well, that's why I went to Tokyo to find out. So I'm standing opposite Harajuku Station, looking down a small hill at Takashitadori. The narrow street was as far back as 1980s, this important spot for local fashion trends. Some of the stores, like Boutique Takenoko, have been around for a lot longer than I've been alive. It's a Monday afternoon, and even though it's raining, the street is jam-packed, mostly with tourists, though. It's so crowded that you can't even see the street anymore. It's just this sea of umbrellas as far as I can see.
Okay, yeah, you're right. That is a lot of people, especially on a day with weather like this. I wouldn't want to be out there, but for listeners who don't know anything about the neighborhood, where is Harajuku?
It's a district in Shibuya, which is a special ward, this part of central Tokyo. I think most people know of Shibuya as the famous pedestrian crossing and think that's it. But really, it's a much larger area that's home to more than 230,000 people. In the middle of Shibuya is a large urban park called Yoyogi Park. And next to it is Harajuku, this posh, very commercial district that has become synonymous with youth culture and fashion. Now, the reason I'm mentioning Yoyogi Park is because the park itself actually plays a role in the story of how this neighborhood, of all the places in Japan, became so associated with fashion. The history of this actually goes pretty deep. So, way back in the 1920s, Yoyogi Park had two things going for it. It had the Meiji Shrine, an important Shinto shrine, and it was a space the Japanese military used for parades and stuff like that. But by most accounts, it was a pretty sleepy corner of Tokyo. Here's Yana Katzenberg again.
There wasn't much. People didn't really come to Harajuku except for the New Year's first shrine visit, but otherwise it was just quiet. Nothing there really.
But fast forward to the late 1940s. Now, Japan had just surrendered at the end of World War II, and the United States was running the occupied government. The U.S. occupation built barracks and military housing in Yoyogi Park. This brought embassies and international companies to the area, and it was fast becoming this very international area when the Japanese government decided that it was the perfect place for a very big, very international event.
The remarkable recovery the Japanese have made since World War II is a matter of record. And now they tackle the Olympic Games set for October 64, determined that it give further indication of a revitalized nation.
The 1964 Summer Games in Tokyo.
The association with fashion also started from what came beyond the Olympics. So you had the first katakana professions. Katakana is one set of Japanese alphabet that is used to write out foreign imported words. So whatever was written out or like Western inspired or new jobs like stylists or models or media talent, they were kind of called the katakana professionals because their jobs didn't exist beforehand in this kind of way. That kind of became the gathering spot for young creatives, new professions. And I would say that was like the point where fashion came into play.
Okay, so we're now in the 1970s, 1980s. Harajuku is this hip, fashionable place full of young TV stars, stylists, models. What happens next?
So that's what brought me to Tokyo in the first place. Because if you want to know about the moment Harajuku fashion really took off, who better to ask than the man who was there to document it all? You're hearing Shoichi Aoki, the founder of Fruits magazine. Aoki was dressed in loose-fitting jeans and an army green bomber jacket, his white hair purposely messy, and a pair of wraparound Oakley glasses atop his nose. He's something of a legend in the Japanese fashion industry. With his magazine Fruits, he pioneered the use of street photography to document fashion subcultures. According to Aoki, fashion in the early 1990s was, at least according to him, incredibly boring. It was a lot of big name brand designers, Western influences, this obsession with this sort of modern, sleek, monochromatic outfits. You think 1980s futurism or something along those lines. But Aoki is really specific here. In 1996, something radically different was happening. This new, colorful, very local sense of style was appearing on the streets of Harajuku. Aoki describes it as being like a tree that took root. The fashion came out of it, like a tree would bear fruit.
Hence, Fruits magazine.
He says the magazine was named Fruits because the colorful styles at the time reminded him of oranges and strawberries. The name also implies that these were sort of fresh. They were something new. Here's Yana on what was happening.
Aoki-san, he already was documenting streetwear basically in his backyard in Harajuku. He would just go out and kind of try to capture the most interesting people. Who was on the cover of Fruits, for example, would be somebody who's very influential in some sort of way, or at least very talented. You had these looks that were very representative of Fruits, and those looks that were very, you know, that still are very much seen as Harajuku fashion, quote unquote, internationally.
It was during this era that things just really got huge. You had all these fashion magazines documenting street fashion in Tokyo. You had all these new subcultures popping up, each with their own really distinct looks and fashion ethos. You had cyber, decora, gothic, visual kei, garu. It was a time when everything was new and exciting, and the world's eyes were on Harajuku.
How long did this excitement last? I have a feeling there's a turning point coming here.
For decades, but yes, your feeling would be right.
Hey, kittens. I'm sorry. I just found out that kid on the Gothic Lolita Bible, I'm finishing this year. It's first the Fruits magazine that closed down. And now it's Kira and the Gothic and Lolita one.
The year was 2017, and a lot of the subcultures that once commanded so much attention in Harajuku were sort of fading away. As these subcultures died out, three of the most important magazines that once served as fan base decided to stop publishing, including Fruits. And as the fans heard the news, these tearful goodbyes started to pop up on social media.
And to be honest, this comes with a massive shock.
The ending of Fruits magazine, Keta magazine, and the Gothic and Lolita Bible. And saying it all together like that makes it sound a lot worse. Oh no.
What happened?
Well, it's sort of complicated. Some of what happened was what always happens with fashion. People moved on. Tastes and trends change over time. People rarely wear the same things for decades at a time.
But then why wasn't there something new coming out of Harajuku? It sounds like this is something bigger than just a few trends falling out of fashion.
You're right, it was definitely larger than that. And according to Aoki, the problem had to do with fast fashion. Aoki is saying here that he views fast fashion as this destructive act. Basically, fast fashion is fast. And the fact that large corporations can co-opt new styles and release these cheaply made clothes to a mass audience is killing the kinds of small, independent fashion labels that made Harajuku such an exciting place. When everything is available to everyone at a low cost, it basically makes fashion something that's disposable. In an environment like that, it's difficult for smaller or more creative or out there labels to earn enough money to support a real life subculture. You can actually see the impact of this in Harajuku today. While the neighborhood is often crowded, a lot of the people you see there are actually tourists. Many who come to Harajuku with an idea of the place formed during the height of its fashion scene. Aoki said Harajuku today is no longer a place where new fashion is born.
But the title of your piece is Harajuku's Rebirth, so this can't be the end of the story.
You're right. Some subcultures that formed back in the first wave of Harajuku style are now experiencing a resurgence. And here's what's interesting about this. These subcultures, and they are subcultures more than just fashion trends, they're doing something pretty rare. Most subcultures are, at their core, youth culture. And youth culture is always changing because people keep getting old. So what was once young and hip is then old and passé within 5 years or so.
Okay, so trends like disco, hippie, emo.
Exactly. I spoke with Larissa Wingy, who studies subcultures and fashion at Michigan State University in the U.S. And she explained the typical life cycle of a subculture or trend.
Subcultures, once they become commodified, they usually disappear, right? So think about the hipster and the fedora and maybe even the beard. That goes around. It circulates, particularly in the United States. And then eventually, you start to see big box stores like Target and stores like that, Walmart. You start to see them carrying these items that the subculture is wearing. And very quickly, the subculture has lost its cachet. It is no longer going to be influential. When that fashion style fades, then so does that group. And this is where I think the Japanese subcultures have a little bit of magic.
Magic?
Yeah, what Larissa is saying here is that these subcultures themselves are inherently commodified. These are head-to-toe looks that you can buy from shops that are dedicated to one or two specific styles. Yet, because this fashion is so clearly different from what most people's normal day-to-day clothes look like, it still retains this level of subversiveness, according to Larissa's research. And it's this strong identity that's one of the reasons why a subculture can fall off the radar and then suddenly come back.
Japanese subcultures have not only this longevity to them, but also that they resurge over time, because that isn't usually what happens with subcultures. And so it is surprising how they are able to maintain. And even if they start to dissolve, they resurge, things may look a little bit different, but it's still that subculture. It's a really fascinating phenomenon when you find a subculture that can sustain itself or come back.
Therissa was in Harajuku studying subcultures during the neighborhood's most creative years, the early 2000s, where she saw the formation of many of the styles that came to define the so-called Harajuku look. She said the neighborhood itself played a big role in sustaining so many distinct subcultures.
I mean, I remember being a punk in the 70s in the Midwest. And there was nothing. Like, I had to dye my t-shirts black. There were no black t-shirts. So it really was difficult to imagine a subculture where you literally have an entire district or two dedicated to your dress that you could purchase these things.
I heard this from other people I spoke with as well.
And I've heard from lots and lots of people I've interviewed who said it had to be Harajuku. It had this strange power.
And it's why young people who are trying to bring back some of these subcultures, they still want to do it in Harajuku. During my trip, I met with Nico, a local fashion influencer, who is also a rising star in the Decora fashion world. Decora is this really distinct Harajuku fashion that takes this really maximalist approach to everything. Everything is pastels like pink, blue, and green. It's all heavily layered, heavily accessorized, basically layers upon layers of bows and ribbons and bracelets. It's a style that most experts in this world, including Aoki and Yana, see as the most visible of the Harajuku fashion scenes.
Decora fashion, I think that is very much what people think of if I say Harajuku fashion.
次は原宿。原宿。折れ口は右側です。Nico hosts a regular meetup in Harajuku called Neo Decora Kai, and it's really breathing a new life into this scene. When I met with Nico, there were about 30 other people waiting outside the Harajuku train station, all of them dressed in these outrageous outfits that were incredibly colorful, but also pretty uniform in their individual looks. I then followed along as they basically did a small parade through Harajuku, stopping at various locations to shop or take photos together. What really struck me was how everyone else reacted. Remember, this is a district that's now full of tourists, and a lot of them were in Harajuku in the first place because they had some familiarity with what the place used to be like. See, here was exactly that, and people were quick to ask for selfies. Nico and her crew were clearly the center of attention.
Harajuku fashion の一個の点になりたいなと思ってます。
She told me that it was her mission to leave a mark on the Harajuku fashion scene. This event is one of her ways of finding a place within Harajuku. But it's also doing exactly what made Harajuku such a fertile ground for fashion in the first place. It's making space for new people to come out and join. And in the process, it's creating a culture all its own.
To me, the most interesting aspect in all of this is the role subcultures of Harajuku have played in subverting conservative values. Ultimately, it seems that purpose is what draws in a greater international audience, made up of people looking to shake up the unrelenting drawl of everyday life. Who wouldn't want the confidence enough to walk out in a huge pink, green, or blue outfit and relish in the stares, to stand out in a crowd of millions?